Who else is that? Aretha. Aretha Franklin. Don't Play That Song. Probably one of the best songs of all time, at least from my perspective. On this day in 1970, certified gold. This is Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with James Risen about his work, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. He was a New York Times reporter who was responsible in part for the New York Times article that hit the Bush administration on the use of warrantless surveillance. He won a Pulitzer Prize for that. It was supposed to come out the year before, but did not because of pressure from the federal government and CIA on the New York Times not to publish it, especially during their election year, but for other reasons as well. And then wrote this book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, and began the investigation by both the Bush and the Obama administrations, which could lead to his jailing if he does not really reveal his sources, which we'll talk a little bit about in the course of this conversation. And James Risen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. I really do. I've read your books and the work you've done before, and I think that this. I want to begin this way because I want to kind of contextualize this conversation about the work you've done and what you've discovered. And one of the things that seemed to really hit me here, overarchingly, is that you're talking about a national security apparatus that in the last 13 years that has really engulfed America almost unseen and in some remarks unfelt, but powerful, more powerful, I think, than most people realize.
Yeah, I mean, that's the theme, I guess, generally of all my work is since 9/11 has been that we, if you remember Dick Cheney's line that the gloves are going to come off.
Yes.
Said that right after 9/11.
Right.
What I've realized is what he really meant was we are going to deregulate national security. And by that, I mean, we're going to take the rule. We're not going to have any rules anymore. We're going to get rid of all the reforms and the regulations that were put in place in the post-Watergate era to kind of, force, you know, the rule of law on the national security community, and that after all the CIA abuses of the 1970s were found out. And Cheney basically was saying, we're going to get rid of all those rules, we're going to deregulate. And at the same time, the government, the Bush administration and Congress, poured hundreds of billions of dollars into the post-9/11 counterterrorism world. We created new agencies and new operations. And so the combination of deregulating national security, at the same time we poured hundreds of billions of dollars into it, led, in my mind, to a national security crisis that we've never acknowledged. And to me, it's kind of like the banking crisis we've had, which was a deregulated industry in which we poured hundreds of billions of dollars. And so we've had this enormous new apparatus, but with lots of unintended consequences. And layered on top of that has been secrecy and the suppression of dissent by a crackdown on whistleblowers so that almost no one knows what's really been going on.
And which is part of what you've revealed in both these books and in the other work you've done. And another thing just contextually I think is important here is to this arc from how you describe in both books, the arc of the administration of George Bush's administration kind of creating this national security counterism apparatus on almost kind of, I think you might even use the word haphazardly, but that what President Obama has done is to make it permanent, to make it part of our daily life and really solidified it. This is a scary arc you're painting here.
That's to me is the more dangerous. I mean, you could almost, in hindsight, almost, you know, not quite, but almost understand why Bush and Cheney, you know, they were kind of panicked and they did a lot of things haphazardly. And to me, the legacy of Barack Obama is to make the national security state, the post-9/11 national security state, permanent and put it on a bipartisan basis, which makes it far more difficult to ever get rid of.
And so parsing out some more, I mean, I think that because I've also seen you write that, you know, that you were kind of shocked at first about this in the Obama administration, not just your persecution.
Yeah, I mean, you remember 2008, Barack Obama said he was all about hope and change and about, the anti-Bush. He was elected basically as being the anti-Bush. And He said he was opposed to the war in Iraq and that he didn't want dumb wars, I think was his phrase. And he was opposed to torture and thought that there had been a lot of excesses in the Bush administration. And I think that was key to his election. And then he got in, and I think what he did was he made a strategic decision that he wanted to focus on domestic policy and the economy, and he wasn't going to, and he was going to allow a continuation of Bush policies on national security. And he extended and expanded those programs far more than he's ever acknowledged. And, you know, he has created on his watch a massive national security apparatus that goes far beyond what Bush and Cheney created.
Well, several thoughts about that. I mean, one is, I mean, how much of this do you think is driven by, as you put it, the hundreds of billions of dollars that has become invested in this world right. of intelligence that has kind of created its own industry way beyond the government?
Absolutely. And, you know, to me, it's kind of like if you look back at the Middle Ages, the 30 Years' War in Germany was all about religious fights between Protestants and Catholics. And the religious wars of the Middle Ages went on forever. And one of the consequences of those wars was to create a new mercenary class. And those mercenaries who fought in the 30 Years' War began to sell their services all around Europe, in Italy and places like that. And so I think that's what's happened here. We have had 13 years of endless war, and we now have a whole new mercenary class of people who are deeply invested in making sure that we stay at war with somebody.
And
you know, they won't get paid unless we are at war.
And I think that some of the things you articulate as well, to just expand on that, is that since this war on terror is bipartisan now, because everybody supports this idea that we have to do the Republican, Democrats, Independents, the majority of the representatives in Congress and more, then what's our way out?
Well, that's a great question, and I wish I knew the answer to that one. I mean, I think the problem, as I said, Obama, you know, made it far more difficult to oppose this. Democrats now, you know, you see a few Democrats who raise questions, and you see a few libertarian Republicans who raise questions. But, you know, it's very easy to do fear-mongering and get elected by being a fear-monger. All you have to do is, you know, say that someone who's criticizing some aspect of the war on terror is soft on terrorism. And so politicians, you know, the easiest thing for them to do is join the hype and hype the war. You know, ISIS in Iraq, it's obviously a nasty, violent, bad group, but they had not attacked the United States. They were in the U.S. intelligence community said they did not pose an imminent threat to the United States. And yet we have, you know, gone back into Iraq because of this group, because of, you know, the belief among politicians that we can't allow, you know, we can't not get involved. And so we end up in this whack-a-mole strategy where we have these short-term tactical operations where we're going to bomb somebody for a while and not deal with the underlying issues involved in those countries.
And it's also when I think about the Pulitzer Prize you won for kind of exposing this warrantless wiretapping by the National Security Agency, which is now that story has taken on a life of its own and keeps expanding. And you look at what's because of Snowden and what he's released as well. This picture's being painted now of a world that's almost out of control.
Yeah, I think basically what Snowden revealed to my mind was, you know, in our stories, we had kind of shown the broad outlines of the Bush-era domestic spying operation. But what Snowden has contributed, I think, is to show how much that grew over time, especially under Obama, because of the growth of social media and the online presence of Americans. our lives have become far more digital with Facebook and Twitter and all the other things, social media. And the NSA kind of secretly shadowed that growth, and their domestic spying operations exploded under Barack Obama.
So, you know, I want to take a little shift here because I think there's in that it's not absurdity, but it's almost like theater of the absurd, but it's reality, and that part's frightening. You have a chapter in your book, and I love the title of the chapter, which is The Emperor of the War on Terror.
Yeah.
About Dennis Montgomery.
Right. That story, it's hard to make up.
It really is. I couldn't believe it when I read it. I mean, this can't be true.
Yeah. It's to me, like, the best story about the war on terror. Dennis Montgomery was a guy who was a computer software expert who convinced numerous federal agencies that he had special skills and special technology that could do various forms of object identification. And one of the things he convinced the CIA that he could do was decipher secret Al-Qaeda codes hidden in the broadcasts of the Al Jazeera news network. And that the CIA, after working with Montgomery, became convinced that Al Jazeera was the way in which Al-Qaeda was sending out codes to its agents on what to attack and when to attack. And so his little office in Nevada became like this hotbed of CIA activity in 2003. And they were sending him just reel after reel after reel of Al Jazeera broadcasts. And he was sending back numbers and letters that he claimed he was reading and deciphering that were embedded in the Al Jazeera in the banner on the Al Jazeera broadcast. And the Bush administration and the CIA took this so seriously that they assumed that the letters and numbers corresponded to international flights. And they grounded a whole series of flights at Christmas time 2003, which you may recall.
Yes.
That was because of the information they were getting from Dennis Montgomery. And in the immediate aftermath of that, there was actually a meeting at the White House where they discussed shooting down the planes over the Atlantic based on his information. So it was taken extremely seriously by the CIA and the Bush administration. And then when the French intelligence proved that this was a fabrication, the CIA just covered the whole thing up, never said a word about it. No one was held accountable. And Montgomery kept getting new contracts with the military and other parts of the government.
It's as if the one part of the government doesn't speak to the other.
Right.
Well, these vast intelligence complex.
Nobody wanted to admit that they screwed up.
And I mean, the fact that the French intelligence actually found this out,
right.
I looked at it and said, "This is poppycock. This is not real. What are you talking about?" I mean,
it was because the flights from Paris were being grounded, and they were not happy about that.
but I'm laughing. But what the scary part is you have this huge intelligence apparatus, which you're describing in this book, and as you have described in interviews as well, but they can make these horrendous mistakes.
Right, and they keep everything secret, so no one's ever held accountable. And to me, that's the great problem with their crackdown on whistleblowers. They're trying to prevent anybody from knowing exactly what they're doing so they continue to do all this kind of stuff without any oversight, without any real supervision. You know, they keep saying, well, Congress provides oversight. Well, Congress doesn't do any real oversight anymore. Basically, without whistleblowers, they're basically allowed to continue to do this completely in the dark.
So, in speaking of whistleblowers, there's this chapter in your book, which I think is a very critical chapter, on Bill and Diane Rorick and Tom Drake and others on the early whistleblowers.
Right. Diane Rorick, I think, is kind of one of my heroes. She's a woman who hasn't gotten very much attention in the past. And she was House Intelligence Committee's staff person in charge of oversight of the NSA at the time of 9/11. And not long after 9/11, she was told by some people, by Bill Binney, at the NSA about the new domestic spying operations that the Bush administration had put in. And she tried to go all through the government, went to everybody she could think of to try to stop this, including she had a couple very dramatic meetings with Mike Hayden, the NSA director. But she never went to the press, and she stayed within, you know, the government and followed the rules as they were, which are, you know, you can't go leak this stuff to the press. And but she failed in stopping it, and she retired from the government very depressed about the fact that she hadn't been able to stop it. And then when our stories in the New York Times came out disclosing the existence of the program, she was persecuted, or the FBI raided her house because they considered her the prime suspect as our source, just because she had gone to people inside the system to complain about it. And it was, turned her life upside down.
I mean, that part of the book, I mean, the raiding of her house and what happened to her is pretty frightening, but it's part of an arc that you were also part of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the government has been trying to get you to say who your sources are. You refuse to tell them who your sources are. The Supreme Court denied your appeal, and now this trial, you may be forced to go to trial in January, where they're going to try to push you to testify, right?
Yeah, it's kind of up in the air about what the government's doing right now. I'm not quite sure, but that's generally where things stand. Yeah.
So what it means is, if this does go through, and I hope it doesn't, but if it does go through, I mean, you could face prison time for be jailed because you refuse to reveal your sources.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, that's a pretty important proposition for you personally, but also...
Yeah, well, you know, they've been after me now for, 7 years, so
right.
I'm kind of used to the idea. You know, it bothered me for the first couple of years this was going on, but now I'm kind of used to it. And as I say in the book, I wrote this book. This book is my answer to the government. You know, I'm
right.
going to keep writing, I'm going to keep reporting, and I'm going to keep trying to find out things. Because that's the only thing that the government respects, is aggressive investigative reporting.
I agree. And I think that the danger here, is, when I say this to you personally, but it's also a huge danger to American democracy when we kind of muzzle the press and try to stop it from doing its work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's what I'm trying to stand up for. Is I think I'm just doing what just about any other reporter I know would do, which is to stand up for the principles of our profession. This is a bedrock principle of our profession, and we can't function in journalism. We can't function as a democracy without it.
No, I agree, and I'm curious in this whole process, in the conversations, your own conversations with others. I mean, America was attacked in 9/11. We know that there are always forces out there in any in this world that always are after one another, and clearly after part of the United States here. So I think America has to debate with itself what is reasonable in terms of intelligence and what to look for and what's not.
Right. I mean, I just think we have to remember, you know, terrorism is not, by definition, terrorism is designed to terrorize a society, which
right.
means they're trying to make you change the way you behave. They're not, terrorism is not an existential threat to a society.
Right.
It's a threat to force you to panic. And that's what the whole purpose of terrorism is, make you panic, make you do things to change the nature of your society. And I think, unfortunately, we have done that to ourselves since 9/11. We've overreacted, and we've allowed the government to allow the transformation of the national security state with very little debate And I think one thing that surprises me is that after 13 years, there's still so little debate about this.
But you're creating that debate. I mean, there's just one final thing here. But I think that because the part of it, I think that you expose things over many things. And of course, the one thing that, again, that shows more of the absurdity of this was what really got them after you on some levels was the CIA operation around the Iranian nuclear weapons program.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, again, that actually they did this in this way and that you exposed it.
Right. Yeah, I think they were just embarrassed and angry at me. And I think basically they were really after me. I think they were just looking for something else to come after me because they were mad about the NSA stories that I did with Eric Lischblau at the New York Times. And I think my own view is they decided eventually they weren't going to go after the New York Times and us for that, because that would have led to a big constitutional showdown with
right.
the New York Times.
Right.
And so I think they looked for things to come after me on that were in my book, but not in the New York Times. And I know for a fact that they conducted leak investigations of several chapters of my State of War, and I think they just picked one, frankly.
Well, I just want to say that many of us have a great deal of respect for you. I have a lot of friends who work at the New York Times that have a huge respect for you as well.
Well, thank you, and I'm
happy you could join us for this brief amount of time on the show. We look forward to talking to you again, and we wish you luck. And we are, as journalists and people in the media, we stand with you to stand up. So,
well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Wish you all the luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, James
Appreciate
Risen. Thank you so much. We've been talking with James Risen, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times. His latest book, "Pay Any Price: Greed, Power, and Endless War," and his former book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. He's still being prosecuted by the Obama administration, started in the Bush administration. We'll see where history takes us, and we'll stay in touch with him as well. The great Sonny Chris, Blues for Boppers. He was born on this day in 1927.